Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode on Rising Above Shadows of Abuse, RASA. I'm your host, Grace Hopper. This is where we discuss and talk about everything relating to abuse, mental health, society, and culture. Today's episode centers around world news and abuse from Nigeria, where children were adopted from their school while sleeping, to femicide. Man killing his wife, a mother stabbing her child for 10 days while she was on vacation in the US, to rape and sexual assault by parents of four young children in France. Our first newsreel is from the Mirror News, 5th of March 2024, by Anthony Clement Thrower. A doctor who vanished more than 6 months ago has been found dead, buried under her own patio. Dr. Glabenia Sepa-Costa was last seen in July 22, 2023, and police in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, began a search in January. Dr. Costa, 53, was found buried under the patio of her home yesterday afternoon. Police quizzed a murder suspect after he was arrested, who reportedly told the police where to find her body as well as the knife he allegedly used to kill her. The police say Dr. Costa's social media and bank accounts were used after her death to make it seem like she was still alive. In December, an Instagram post was posted to her 10,000 Instagram, and it reads, "Please just understand that I'm okay the way I want to be. If you don't understand what deep depression is, don't bother me. I just want peace. For now, I'm simply asking, not demanding. In my own way, I'm doing well." Dr. Costa's car, which was registered in the suspect's name, has been seized by the police. The doctor lived in Rio das Ostras, near Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, where she reportedly specialized in endocrinology. The police say the suspect will be charged with concealment of a corpse and femicide. Others, including his wife, will also be questioned as suspects. Their names and the suspected motives are withheld as the investigation continues. Dr. Costa wrote she was passionate about health, exercise, dance, and her pets in her Instagram bio. A former patient, Denise, said, "She saved my life when I had a heart attack in Arareal do Cabo 10 years ago. May God have welcomed her and may she be in a much better place." Another added, "Shocked to see so many people calling her friend, but she disappeared since July 2023 and no one asks where she was. What happened? If it wasn't for the public ministry to go back because of work, she would be disappeared by now." What do you think about this newsreel? It's quite shocking that for 6 months, nobody knew the whereabouts of Dr. Costa. And they didn't even bother to start making inquiries. Yet, she was their doctor and a friend and possibly a neighbor. What does that say about the society we are living in nowadays? Are we our brother's keepers? Kindly leave your views, comments, and thoughts and feelings via our social media handle or our email address, risingaboveshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. Thank you. Our next newsreel is from Nigeria. World News, Associated Press, 9th of March, 2024. Armed men broke into a boarding school in northwestern Nigeria early Saturday and seized 15 children as they slept, police told the Associated Press. About 48 hours after, nearly 300 students were taken hostage in the conflict hit region. School options are common in Nigeria's northern region, especially since the 2014 kidnapping of more than 200 schoolgirls by Islamic extremists in Borno State, Chibok village, which shocked the world. Armed gangs have since targeted schools for kidnap runs, resulting in at least 1,400 abducted since then. The gunmen in the latest attack invaded the Gidan Bakuso village of the Gada Council area in Sokoto State at about 1 a.m. local time, police said. They headed to the Islamic school where they seized the children from their hostels before security forces could arrive. Sokoto police spokesman Ahmad Rufai told the Associated Press. One woman who was also adopted from the village, Rufai said, adding that a police tactical squad was deployed to search for the students. The inaccessible roads in the area, however, challenged the rescue operation, he said, adding, it is a remote village and vehicles cannot go there. They, the police squad, had to use motorcycles to the village. Saturday's attack was the third mass kidnapping in northern Nigeria since late last week, when more than 200 people, mostly children, women, were adopted by suspected extremists in Borno State. On Thursday, 287 students were also taken hostage from a government primary and secondary school in Kaduna State. The attacks highlight once again a security crisis that has plagued Africa's most populous country. Kidnappings for ransoms have become lucrative across Nigeria's northern region, where dozens of armed gangs operate. No group claimed responsibility for any of the abductions, while Islamic extremists who are waging an insurgency in northeastern Nigeria are suspected of carrying out the kidnapping in Borno State. Locals blame the school kidnappings on herders who have been in conflict with their host communities before taking up arms. Nigeria's Vice President Kashim Shettima, meanwhile, met with authorities and some parents of the adopted students in Kaduna State on Saturday and assured them of efforts by security forces to find the children and rescue them. That is the state of the community back in northern Nigeria. What do you think? Are security forces not doing their job properly? Why are they targeting children and women? Has it got to do with the fact that children and women can work in farmlands? What are the men doing about this? I'm talking about able-bodied men in those regions. Why are there no vigilantes? Why are there no mounting security posts to ensure that their women and children are safe? What do you think? Leave your opinions and views. Our email address, Rising Above Shadows of Abuse. Thank you. Our next newsreel is from London, UK, by iNews, Nels Abbey. 12th of March 2024. Over the years, there has been a seemingly permanent loss for Diana Abbott, the first Black female MP in the UK. She's been a pioneer many times over in the realms of politics, physics, and psychoactivity. She's Britain's first Black female MP, as because of this, she's a lightning rod for racism and something of a truth serum for racists. When it comes to Diane, even the most sophisticated and seasoned of British racists, respected globally for their civility, can no longer conceal their bigotry. So it should come as no shock to learn that the Conservative Party's largest donor, Frank Hester, allegedly made comments that pathologized Diana Abbott onto all Black women. This is a concept known as racism, and spoke of how she should be shot depending on who you are. This is a concept known as violent racism or incitement to racism. Diana Abbott is not a vast vote swayer or threat to Conservative Party rule or a competitor to Mr. Hester and his ilk. Yet there is a seemingly permanent loss for her blood, politically and now it would appear literally. But this is nothing new. For decades now, the mildest of Abbott's errors, such as having a drink on a sunny day on a train, develop lives of their own. Her more serious errors, which are mild by comparison to the likes of, say, Boris Johnson, are treated as earth-shattering capital crimes. But in the treatment of Diana Abbott, we learn about the true nature of Britain. Something never felt right about Rishi Sunak's post-George Galloway Victory Downing Street speech on racism, extremism, and British confidence. I could not quite put my finger on it then, but in light of his silence and refusal to call out the Islamophobia of Lee Anderson and now the alleged racism of Frank Hester, the penny has dropped. It was just words, words with no relationship with reality in retrospect. The speech on the Downing Street steps was one of the poorer party political broadcasts of our time, self-serving and insincere. Racism in politics is rife, and the likes of Sunak, who should be a symbol of anti-racist progress, is the opposite of what he posits himself as. If he cannot call out and condemn the alleged call for the shooting of a fellow MP on the basis that she is black, then what on earth difference does he make to Britain as the first non-white prime minister? No one should be fooled by the crocodile tears of the Labour Party either. Some of the worst incidents of racism Diana Abbott has had to contend with over the years have come from within her own trenches, from which she is currently suspended. For the most part, the Conservative Party has made Diana Abbott contend with words. Labour have made her contend with actions. It was not Tory party officials who pointed reporters to the toilets then Shadow Home Secretary Diana Abbott had sought refuge in to shed tears during the 2017 election, and it was also not Conservative donors who made a Labour MP a star for claiming to have told Diana to F off. Hence, it should come as no shock that Labour are investing more in turning this into a squabble after funding than a soul searching on how the machinery of politics treats black women. It should be noted that Labour treats black men just as badly, if not worse, than it does black women. And if you think racism in politics is bad, brace yourself for news on racism in policing and prosecutions. Case in point, some people have called for the Conservative Party to give Hester back the £10 million he gifted to them. Some have suggested he be stripped of his OBE. I personally would not care less if either of those things happen, but he should be subjected to the same fate of many black and brown people across Britain for sharing anti-racist emojis or engaging in intra-communal political critique. His phone could be seized, his body searched, he could be handcuffed and thrown in the back of a police van, then left to languish in a police cell for 10 hours. The police could shout and scream at him during questioning, then formally arrest him. The Crown Prosecution Service could charge and prosecute him, but that is not enough. His family may be publicly named and shamed in newspapers for the crime of being related to him. And no matter the outcome of the case, he will be left fighting depression. Like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X before her, Diana Abbott will become a gushingly beloved figure in Britain only when she's in the grave and can be manipulated to the benefit of the establishment. At that moment, she can be reduced to a single self-serving, the const textualized soundbite, like every racist's favorite Martin Luther King quote, to not judge by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. This is quite deep. What are your views regarding Diana Abbott's racial abuse by Tory donor Frank Hester via email address rising above shadows of abuse at gmail.com? Thank you. Our next news reels from USA, Orange County, Mirror News by Abigail O'Leary. 16th of March, 2024. A doctor who strangled his wife to death, Eric Scott Seals, 58, was sentenced for one count of second-degree murder in the death of his wife, Suzanne, with prosecutors saying he staged her death as a fall down the stairs. Californian fertility doctor was sentenced on Friday to 15 years to life in prison for the murder of his wife in an incident authorities said was made to look like an accident. The Orange County District Attorney's Office said authorities say Seals called 911 in November 2016 and said he found his wife's body after she apparently fell down the stairs in their home in San Clemente, which is about halfway between Los Angeles and San Diego. But evidence showed she died from strangulation, and bloodstains were found in the room where she had been sleeping, the district attorney's office said in a statement. Seals was arrested in 2019 and found guilty by a jury in December. A message seeking comment was sent to his attorney, Jack Early. Tensions in the couple's marriage arose after Suzanne posted a nude photo of herself online after she lost a bet over Donald Trump's 2016 election win. Seal was arrested in 2019 over the November 2016 killing and found guilty by a jury in December last year, 2023. Prosecutors described how Seal had made a frantic phone call on the day of the killing, telling a 911 operator he woke up and found the lifeless body of his wife at the foot of the stairs. However, it was heard how Suzanne died due to strangulation, with bloodstains found on the wall and cuttings in their daughter's bedroom, where Suzanne was sleeping due to headache, along with a clump of hair found in the same room. The evidence suggested a violent struggle had occurred inside the room. Prosecutors labeled the murder a staged accident. The court also heard how the couple were often arguing, with jurors seeing a printout of one blue screen, in which was suggested Suzanne posted a topless photo of herself online after losing a bet as relates to Trump's election win. A printout of a chart was found in his office after her death, along with another, in which Suzanne says she wants out. Suzanne had been married to the well-off medical doctor for more than 10 years and also doubled as the co-founder of the Carlsbad IVF and infertility practice where her husband worked as the head of medical operations. What do you think about this newsreel? Do you think the doctor should have been given a second degree murder charge? What would have prompted him to strangulate his wife and commit femicide, or will I call it murder? Has it got to do with the fact that she wants out, that is, she wanted a divorce? That could mean getting a huge alimony payout to the wife. I leave you viewers and listeners to deliberate on this particular. Leave your feelings, your thoughts via email address risingaboveshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. Independent News, 17th of March 2024, by Alicia Rahman Sarkar. The video of a racially abused teenager was captured on camera as he was being beaten up. Four teenage boys have been arrested after a video of a racially aggravated hate incident against a black school student in Calais triggered public uproar on social media near St. John Henry Newman's Catholic School. The survivor was repeatedly harassed and issued several blows before being forced to kiss the white teenager's shoes, the distressing video shows. In another clip purportedly filmed after the incident, the white teenager was seen following the survivor up the street and punching him twice before onlookers intervened. The video shared on Friday garnered over 6 million views on X, triggering an uproar over the blatantly racist incident. Racism in the UK is getting worse every day. Are black people not safe in? Social media user Olumo of Derby captioned the video. After the video went viral, the Cumbria police on Saturday morning initially arrested a teenage boy and said it was aware of concerns in the community. The force urged people not to share the video in order not to impede any legal proceedings or to identify any of the children involved. Parents gathered outside the school premises and said they were there to give support to the children and confidence that their parents, the black parents, have their back. One of the parents, Paul, said, "We are saying don't be afraid. We need to nip these things in the bud now. Things are getting out of hand." Paul was amongst the 30 black parents and supporters outside the school on Monday morning. They were very angry and wanted answers as relates to the racially abused teenager. The boy's mother and supporters held a meeting with a senior teacher and school governors as the protesters waited with handmade signs and as the protesters waited with handmade signs that expressed their anger. Janet Walker, the chief executive of the campaign group Anti-Racist Cumbria, was at the meeting and said afterwards that it had been encouraging, but that it was early days. She said incidents like these were too often blamed on bad apples. "It's not just bad apples," she said. "We have got deep-rooted racism in society, and we need to look at how we can improve this and stop blaming it on individuals. This is eating deeper and deeper into the society in the UK. Kelvin Enabulele said he had been racially assaulted in Calais 16 years ago, so the reports brought back grim memories. "It's happening in schools across Cumbria, and the issue is how does this school handle it? What do they do about it?" he said. We need to see things happening, that is, changes. The police later in the day announced the arrest of three more white teenagers, all from Kalai. One of the teenagers was arrested on suspicion of racially aggravated actual bodily harm, and the other three were arrested on suspicion of abetting racially aggravated actual bodily harm. These are abhorrent images circulating online that have caused shock and concern in both the community and among officers here at Cumbria Police, said Superintendent Sarah Jones in a statement. She added, "We can reassure the community this is an incident we are taking very seriously, and we have made four arrests. Our officers have worked through the night and continue to carry out investigations today. Police will be increasing patrols in Kalai in response to concerns from the community." What do you think about this? Should Black students start working in groups in order to avoid this kind of incidents? Or school authorities talk about the negative impact of racism or any form of abuse amongst students? What should be done to these four white teenagers that racially abused this Black teenager? Leave your views and your comments and feelings via our email address. The next newsreel is from France. Pedophile parents who preyed on their own children and left the town in tatters, by Pierre Willicks. Tuesday, the 19th of March, 2024. Tara DeLay and Miriam Badao had been living in the French northern town of Autreux when school teachers and social workers started to express concern about the behavior of their four sons. 5-year-old Jonathan DeLay, the third child, had asked a foster carer to watch an X-rated video with him, which immediately sent alarm bells ringing. What happened next is a real-life horror story of pedophile rings, incredulous lies, and horrendous abuse, and all detailed in the new Netflix documentary, The Autreux Case, A French Nightmare. In short, it's one of the biggest scandals in French history. Before the sexual abuse was uncovered, Jonathan and his brothers were subjected to shocking attacks of violence from their father, Thierry, who beat them with the slats of their beds, forced them to watch porn, and terrified them by waking them up middle of the night while wearing a black cape and mask. "I believe my father is a sick man," Jonathan tells the documentary makers. "Even at night, we are on edge. He'll come into our bedroom and wake us up and scare us just because he felt like it. My mother was different when she wasn't around him, which means that there were some times that we were happier. But I think the only good thing she ever did was to call social services. I think that's the most significant thing she did in her entire life," Jonathan adds poignantly. The allegations of abuse first emerged in 2001 after the boys had been sent into foster care following concerns over domestic abuse in the home. When police then interviewed the children about suspected sexual abuse, they could not have been prepared for what they were told, with allegations being described as abominable. On one drawing he's been asked to make of the family, Jonathan wrote, "When mom and dad have sex, we watch porn." A report from his daycare provider shared another shocking admission from the little boy: his dad would hurt him by penetration. After being questioned by social workers, Jonathan told them how his mom would film the abuse. Following the execution of a search warrant, 160 porn videos were discovered in the family home, as well as a collection of dildos and even 10 human skulls. In 1993, 4 years before accusations began to surface, DeLay had been found guilty of the desecration of grave. After police searched their apartment, one shocking tape showed the couple having sex in the presence of one of their children. The depraved pair were soon charged with rape and sexual abuse. I'm going to stop here, and you can read the rest of the stories by the link on the podcast. What do you think about this? This is frightening. Parents who should be caregivers and make sure that children are safe from harm, the ones actually harming and damaging their children emotionally, psychologically, and physically. Kindly leave your views, your thoughts and feelings about this part via email at our email address, risingaboveshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. Thank you. New York Post, 19th of March, 2024, by Joe Marino and Kyle Schnitzer, George Fitzgibbon. A suspected member of the notorious MS-13 Street Gang is accused of sex trafficking a 17-year-old migrant girl he recruited out of a Queens shelter while still on the RN for allegedly fondling a 9-year-old girl years earlier. Fredo Morosho, 37, who was also hit with a bail jumping charge for skipping out on the 2018 child molestation case, is finally being held on Rikers Island without bail, according to officials and court records. He's now charged with 2 counts of sex trafficking of a child, 5 counts of promoting prostitution, and 2 counts of patronizing a person in prostitution in the new case. No child should ever be exploited, Queens District Attorney Melinda Katz said in a statement. The underage victim in this case was preyed upon for financial gain. The defendant is also accused of having sex with the victim himself. Katz said, I have dedicated significant resources to supporting those impacted by sex trafficking and to hold accountable those who manipulate and take advantage of other people's vulnerabilities. According to the prosecutors, Morosho was on the IM in the 2018 child molestation case when he approached a teen migrant at a Jamaican deli in November and asked if she wanted a job, even after she told him she was underage. Over the following 4 months, he allegedly coerced the girl into prostitution, driving her to and from a Corona apartment for dates with Johns, giving her half the money she collected at the end of the day, prosecutors said. Morosho also coerced the teen to give him semi-nude photos of herself that he could send to prospective customers, according to prosecutors. On March the 6th, he allegedly drove the victim to the Renaissance New York Flushing Hotel at Tangram, where he negotiated a price for the girl's services with a John, not realizing he was an undercover cop. Police slapped the cuffs on him and hit him with the felony charges. Morosho, who authorities believe is tied to MS-13 because of several distinctive tattoos, first got jammed up nearly 6 years ago when he was charged with fondling the younger girl outside the Queens mobile phone shop on September 26, 2018. According to a complaint in the case, the youngster was looking at phones in the display window when she felt someone lift her skirt, touch her butt over her black tights with their hand. When the terrified girl turned around, Morosho allegedly told her, "Don't move. I want to do this longer." Cops caught up with Morosho, who allegedly confessed that he was trying to record her butt. He was charged with unlawful surveillance, sexual abuse, harassment, and endangering the welfare of a child, according to the criminal complaint. His bail was set at $2,500 cash or a $5,000 bond at his arraignment, which he posted, but he blew off a 2019 May court date and had a warrant issued to haul him back into the courtroom. It wasn't until after his prostitution bust that prosecutors were finally able to hit him with a bail jumping charge, according to court records. He's due back in court on March the 28th, 2024. What do you think about this? Please leave your comments via email or on our social media handles. Thank you. The Garden News, Tuesday, 19th of March, 2024, by Ramon Antonio Vargas. Cristel Cardario received sentence after pleading guilty to aggravated murder and child endangerment in death of daughter. An Ohio woman who embarked on a 10-day vacation while leaving her 16-month-old daughter behind at her home to starve to death has been ordered to spend the rest of her life in prison. Cristel, 32, received her sentence on Monday in a state courthouse in Cleveland, after having previously pleaded guilty to one charge, each of aggravated murder and child endangerment in the death of her daughter, Jaleen. The judge who oversaw Candelario's case, Brendan Sheehan, said traveling out of state while leaving a toddler home alone without food was the ultimate betrayal, deserved one of the harshest legal punishments available. Just as you didn't let Jeline out of her confinement, so to you, she spent the rest of your life in a cell without freedom, she had said during Candelario's sentencing hearing. The only difference will be that the prison will at least feed you and give you liquid that you denied her. Candelario, meanwhile, told Sheehan that she prayed daily for forgiveness. There is so much pain that I have in regards to the loss of my baby, Jelaine, said Candelario, who has reportedly struggled with depression and related mental health problems. I'm extremely hurt about everything that has happened. I'm not trying to justify my actions, but nobody knew how much I was suffering and what I was going through. Without elaborating, Candelario concluded, God and my daughter have forgiven me. Prosecutors charged Candelario with going on vacation to Detroit and Puerto Rico beginning on 6th of June while leaving Jelaine behind in a playpen at their home on the edge of Cleveland's West Boulevard neighborhood. A few days into the trip, the New York Post reported Candelario went on social media and posted a photo of herself smiling, barefooted, and in a bathing suit on a beach. The image captioned, "The time that is enjoyed is the true time lived." Candelario did not return home until about 8 a.m. on 16th of June. She found Jelaine unresponsive, atop a liner in the playpen that was soiled with urine and feces, and she called 911. Emergency responders arrived, determined Jelaine was extremely dehydrated, and soon pronounced her death. After an autopsy, the local medical examiner's office ruled Jelaine had died from starvation and severe dehydration. Authorities charged Candelario with murder, with prosecutors indicating they reserved the right to pursue the death penalty against her. Candelario pleaded guilty on 22nd of February as part of a deal that left her facing a maximum sentence of life imprisonment without parole. Prosecutors also agreed to dismiss a related charge of felonious assault. At Monday's sentencing, Sheehan gave Candelario the stiffest punishment available to her, having accounted for her guilty plea. In a statement after the hearing, the Cleveland prosecutor's Michael O'Malley said Candelario demonstrated unimaginable selfishness in murdering Jelaine. The thought of going on vacation for 10 days and leaving your child to starve to death in a pack and play is a new low in parental care, O'Malley said. This is quite heart-rending. What do you think about the actions of this mom? Would you say that she was suffering? The depression got the better of her. Unfortunately, her child died and she has been slammed with life imprisonment without parole. What do you think about this particular newsreel? Please leave your comments, your feelings and thoughts via email at our email address, risingaboveshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. We've come to the end of today's episode. See you next week. Stay safe and be positive. Bye for now. Thank you.